Professor of the University Museum. And he will introduce two speakers of Freddie Stockton. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Audrey. I think I should just spell out right off the rules of this game. We thought that each one of our speakers would talk about 10 minutes, and that would give us plenty of time for discussion afterwards, and we hope that some really interesting ideas for discussion would come out of this. And I'll introduce each one as they speak. I should probably explain to some of you what I'm doing here, why I moderate this thing, and all I can say is that I spent a great deal of time, over 7 years, living with and hunting with Athabascan and Indians and Eskimos. And if you can do that for 7 years and survive, I think you can keep the peace with a group like this all right. So that, without apology for my leading as or acting as a moderator in this discussion, I'd like to introduce our first speaker. He is Denny Leonard, and he is a fellow at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and he comes from the Warm Springs Reservation of the Allied Tribes in Oregon. And he's now preparing to organize a Native American School of Government at the University of Washington. I think he would be talking about his plan for the School of Public Affairs. So with pleasure, I introduce Denny Leonard.
Thank you.
Just pull that speaker over there so we can get into it.
Thank you very much. Well, I should give you a little background on why I'm developing a Native American School of Public Affairs. And I think, as everything, it starts with my own tribal members. It started with my grandmother. And she has been the guiding light for our entire family for many years. And I would often ask her questions when I became confused about issues, about some directions. And one of the questions I had after I'd gone to college was, well, all these people are asking me questions about Indians. You know, why is it you didn't teach me the in-depth knowledge about language, about tribal history, about, you know, how we organized, about what happened before 1855 and the treaty areas? And she'd never answer me. You know, she'd never ask me. I'd ask her, and she'd think, and she'd never answer me. So I kept on trying along, going to school, you know. She'd always say one thing continuously. You know, school's a good thing. You ought to go to school. I like that idea. So, you know, feeling good about my grandmother, feeling good about being educated, I continue on in school. And just this last year, you know, I asked her, again, you know, I was concerned about what I was doing. And that there's a great deal of effort on behalf of a lot of Native Americans to return to their cultural base and identify with the kinds of traditions and values and philosophies which made them feel a part of the earth and a part of a peace that is yet to be known in America. And I think the environmental issue is certainly a part of the problems that have evolved by leaving out the Native American in the development of the country. And her answer to my latest question was, I believe now that all my grandchildren who are being educated are going to protect those people who live by their values and philosophies of their original culture. And I now feel that it's time for me to teach you the history as well as teach you the language as well as teach you the life, she says, because you've reached a point in your education where you can see beyond being assimilated and see into what it takes to be a Native American with an education and not be a non-Native American with an education. She said that that there evidence is that if she did teach me my language and my culture, it may have blinded me at a time when there was such tremendous social pressure on me to change my values and my ways. And that she knew that as long as there was a great deal of love between she and I and she and her grandchildren, that the change would ultimately come when questions would continue to be asked and she would make sure that those happened. And so now she says to me, my life and the life of our children are in your hands, and you are the youth of the reservation. And the life of America, indeed, is going to be in the hands of people just like you, because America cannot withstand the kinds of changes that are going on today. So there has to be new philosophies and new avenues, because Mother Earth cannot take the kinds of devastation that she's been treated with at this time in history. And so she said, I'll let you go along your path of being educated and not teaching you these things, because I wanted to wait until you had the strength and the ability to perceive the world as I perceive it to be, to perceive the changes that needed to be perceived, and to reason and to change and to work with all people on the earth, which is not just Native Americans. And so that kind of wisdom, you know, that kind of benefit that's been educated, that I've had an education, the kinds of attitudes that my grandmother has taught me, I think have made me believe that the Native American School of Public Affairs is not one strictly for Native Americans, and its philosophies and values are not those of just Native Americans, but I think they are philosophies and values which must be shared by us all. The idea of the Native American School of Government is to train Native American tribes, organizations, which may include urban organizations, to work with the Alaskan corporations on management techniques, which would bring about some sort of change and some sort of self-determination that is beyond those self-determinations called for by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I think that change is embedded in the philosophy of knowledge, that gaining knowledge, knowing something that will, in one way or in one form, give you tools to change things, makes you a better person, makes you someone able to control your own lives, able to do things which you believe are valuable to you, valuable to your people. And contemporary Native America now is one which is involved in a technological society, an industrialized society, one which is surviving now on the small parts of the earth that it hasn't devastated to date, one that now seeks out through media and other kinds of advertisements to take as much energy from the earth as possible, and one which now again has to depend on the Native American natural resources as it has in the past. And those legal constraints that are a result of the congressional treaties which were made with Indian tribes, and those kinds of changes which have been brought about by State Department of Education, by local educational agencies which are near reservations, and by intervention of large corporations in the United States, which are multinational in nature, utilizing their legal resources and utilizing their lobbying resources in the Congress as well as elsewhere, have determined that there's a need for natural resources, and there's a tremendous gap in the ability for America to keep herself warm and fed and housed. And they are now looking toward Northern China Reservation, the Alaskan North Slope, looking to the timber resources of the Northwest, the gasification, natural gas of the Southwest, and determining that those large, vast empires, which were usually nothing in terms of natural resources when they were negotiated in behalf of Native Americans and the United States government, are now very valuable. And for that reason, it is a new Emancipation Proclamation attitude of America that says on TV in Montana, you know, America needs the energy that's within the boundaries of the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. That says on TV in Alaska that without the Alaskan oil, we can't survive. And so the attitude of this great land of ours that we can continue to pursue and develop at the expense of anyone who's in our way is not necessarily dead here in the United States. It's still alive, and it's, you can turn it on TV anytime you want. And Native Americans have a chance now, I think, to develop themselves in terms of their resources and turn the resources that they have into something which is viable, and in that viability maintains their culture and their background and preserves the kinds of attitudes and values which are theirs and which have always been there. And the School of Government hopefully will take people who have worked on their reservations, who have worked in their centers, and train them in administration and management, so that they can take the resources which are on their reservation and utilize them for the good of all people, as well as utilize them for the good of their own people, and not at the expense of their people, who will succumb to the management tools that have been brought against them by corporations and by the federal government, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and any other organization whatsoever. And it's to this end that the School of Government is being developed. And it's being developed, I hope, with the spirit of my grandmother, and with the power and intellect that I can achieve going to school, as well as other members of this panel and other members of other reservations can achieve where they are going to school, and preserve both the culture as well as the life of America and the spirit I think that we all are looking for, which is peace and love and harmony among us all. Thank you.
yours, Leonard. And now, Betty Krause, Mail. Mail or Maley?
Maley.
I think we probably were related, as a matter of fact. Aren't you a Seneca?
Yes.
Well, I was taken to the tribe like Bill Fenton.
Oh, you were?
Many years ago, and I even have my lineage to prove it on one of those canes, you know.
Who adopted you?
Well, I can't remember his name. And I can't remember the tribe. That's awful. But I've got that stick, and I can prove it to you. Anyway, Betty Krause Maley is a member of the board of the Indian Rights Association and chairman of the program committee, wife of Dr. Howard Maley, a psychiatrist, and she lives in Princeton. She is a member of the Seneca tribe. I've got that straight. And from the Allegheny Reservation. And I'm glad to see on this list here that her grandmother adopted Bill Fenton, who was the one who later got me adopted into the Seneca tribe. We were at school together. She's been a reporter for the Indian Historical Press and Wasaha. Is that the Iroquois paper?
No, Indian Historian Press is based in San Francisco. I work for...
Oh, I see.
That press was a reporter for Wasaha.
I see. I know I've seen this. She's been a member of the planning committee for the first and second convocation of American Indian Scholars. And she's going to be talking about the activist.
No,
you're not.
No,
I'll leave it to you to say what you're going to talk about there. Good.
As recently as last night, while in conversation with a member of the board of directors of Indian Rights Association, I was confronted with the fact that most of the non-Indians I work with and live among do not know anything about me. Because I do not fit the stereotype image non-Indians have of Native Americans, there is a tendency for some people to discredit or qualify what I have to say on Indian affairs. When I have spoken to classes of school children, they have been disappointed not to see me in buckskin and beads. In a cosmopolitan community such as Princeton, it is interesting to note the acceptance of the stereotype image by well-educated adults. Since my tribalness is not derived from questionable sources, I have not presumed to reinforce the stereotype of the Indian in order to comply with the romantic or racist images, notions of that non-Indians hold. Stereotyping is a form of racism. Textbooks use words such as barbaric, primitive, savage, if they don't ignore us altogether. Films frequently shown on television reinforce the negative image. Caricatures of Indians are used for advertising. Comic strips illustrate us as ugly and stupid and ridiculous. Certainly, no other minority continues to suffer the indignities of stereotyping that the American Indian experiences. The fight to eliminate the Dartmouth Indian and the Stanford Indian was led by sensitive Native American students who are completely aware of the fact that humans are not mascots and Indians are not animals. Although we have been hunted down and shot as animals, and though Indian Affairs are under the Bureau of Indian Affairs within the Department of Interior, and Indians seem to me to be considered an expendable national resource. And this is really what our problem is today and has been historically. As I said before, my tribalness is well established. I am an enrolled member of the Seneca Nation of Indians. I was born on the Allegheny Indian Reservation that John Wittoff spoke about in the first lecture of this last series of three. We lost 10,000 acres of the Allegheny Reservation to the Kenzua Dam Project. I spent part of my childhood in an area that is now under the waters of Kenzua Lake. During that period, I learned from my mother and grandmother how to harvest from nature's bounty foods for our use. And I knew that my grandmother knew all the herbs for medicines. My mother's people are traditional Seneca Longhouse people. As Dr. Rainey mentioned, my grandmother adopted Dr. William Fenton, who was last week's guest speaker, when Dr. Fenton was a young man starting his field studies and camping at my great uncle's place, Jonas Snow's place at Allegheny. Dr. Whithoff, who, by the way, knows my Aunt Clara Redeye and knew my late mother, last week, that was the week before last, effectively described to his audiences the facts that we Indians look at history and politics from a different experience and a different value system than other Americans. There is no doubt that many of us consider the bicentennial a premature celebration of an adolescent nation. Sociologists are fond of saying that we can measure the humanity of a nation by the way it treats its minorities. That's a pretty strong statement for most Americans to have to accept in this bicentennial year in view of what has happened to us. Last week, Dr. Fenton told of all the ways that names of Indian tribes are used and spoke of the numerous places that use names conferred on them by the indigenous tribes. Last weekend, I took a 3-day trip to New York State in Canada, visiting the Onondaga Reservation, the Grand River or Six Nations Reservation in Canada, and the Tuscarora Reservation near Niagara Falls. I was struck by the widespread usage of Iroquoian names in this region that was once entirely under control of the League of the Iroquois. Because of the bicentennial, I have begun boning up on Iroquois history during the Revolutionary War period. Got a lot of work to do. Some of the materials that I have seen have vivid descriptions of what the countryside was like at that time. As I drove by enormous power projects, one especially at the Niagara Power Project on part of the Tuscarora Reservation, and as I witnessed the expanse of built-up territory produced by technological progress, it was frightening to think that all this had happened in 200 years. I was struck by the greed and destruction of so much of the goodness and beauty and for the purpose of the pursuit of wealth, and I wonder where it will all end. At Allegheny, it was easy to defeat the Senecas and condemn our land because people testified before congressional hearings that we didn't use it anyway. The Mohawks in New York State had lost land to the St. Lawrence Seaway Project, the Onondagas to Interstate 81, and the Tuscaroras to the Niagara Power Project. We Senecas at Allegheny lost more land to the widening of Highway 17 through our reservation. And I've seen how the water is being diverted from the reservations in the southwest. I've seen the strip mining and the water waste produced by it at the Four Corners Power Project from the Navajo Reservation. And I've heard about the strip mining at Northern Cheyenne and Crow Reservations. There are other dam projects flooding out Indians in the northwest. The salmon waters are polluted or diverted, and the Western Shoshone are being stripped of their land, and the land is being stripped of the Pinon.
Thank you. And then Mr. George Jackson. I want to point out right away that Mr. Jackson is the one that really had the idea of making this great map of North America out here. We put in the entryway showing the very different groups of American Native Americans here in North America. And I'm very pleased that it's finally up after a few good suggestion of a couple of years ago. He is a Tuscarora Cherokee from North Carolina. They grew up in the Pittsburgh and Philadelphia areas and graduated from Lower Moreland High School and in 1970, he was one of the original founders of the United American Indians of Delaware Valley, and was president until 1972. At the present time, he is quality control manager at Sprague Griffith, a division of Textron, and he's been attending Temple University at night school. He will speak about the problem of urban Indians, in this area from a very personal point of view. Mr. Jackson.
Thank you. Well, I didn't come with a prepared statement because I think we can open it up later for discussions. I could probably, on a one-to-one basis, give you all the information about problems in the urban Philadelphia. The only thing, basic problem, Philadelphia and southeastern Pennsylvania, most of you don't know anything about American Indians. And this was my idea back in 1970 when a group of us decided to form an organization not only to bring out things for non-Indians, but also communicate with Indians all the year here, who had more or less withdrawn into their shells. Security that they thought we had, and also to educate our own children growing up in an urban community where we weren't in touch with the Indian ways and Indian culture. I find that most urban people are not sensitive to the real Indian problems. As we discussed earlier, these problems are regional, and with them not being in this region, they were completely insensitive to Indian problems in other regions of the United States. I would like to say that, as many said, a lot of my feelings about Indians go back to my grandparents. And if and when you do learn about Indians, Native Americans, however you wish to address your press, you will find out that the great respect for the grandparents, it's nothing like there is in any other non-Indian culture. And with that, keeping that in mind, this is the way that we, the United American Indians of Delaware Valley, which I no longer headed up, but they are trying to pass that same thing on. And they are doing very well now. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the organization, but just last week they did get the deed to a new building. I think it's on Chestnut or Walnut Street, third Walnut, from ATW. And they're working with them very closely, and they've set up a very strong organization.
Then Theodore Hetzel, Executive Secretary of the Indian Rights Association, retired professor of engineering at Hereford College, and has been teaching courses in Indian history. Would you start?
Thank you. We were introduced as four Native Americans, which is an honor to me, but undeserved. A corn planter once said that he was 50% German and 100% Indian. And I claim that I'm 100% American, or 50% German, 50% English, and 50% Indian. I do have the honor of having an Indian name, Onguadeo, adopted by the Wolf clan of the Allegheny Senecas. And I can tell you who danced for me, too, and who adopted me, and who my clan mother is, etc. I have a tape recorder here. I might as well turn it off.
I think they should have a right to ask questions or comment, express themselves. I would like to ask you a question here that you seem to feel, or I gather, that the attitudes of most Americans toward Native Americans is still a matter of discrimination Well, I can understand your comments on the sort of taking over of large areas of land of reservations, like building the dam, what's going on in the Crow Country now for the strip mining for coal, these sort of things. I can see it's an imposition on the Indian rights as we once agreed on them. But one thing I would take issue with you. It seems to me that the attitude of ordinary Americans to Native Americans has undergone a tremendous shift in a generation or two. What I'm talking about is this. 40 years ago in Alaska, when you had relatively few stateside people coming into Alaska and a large Native population in Alaska, you had a pretty brutal attitude between the white Americans and the Native peoples. And in the last generation or two, it seems to me that's changed enormously. That there's a totally different attitude toward the Native Americans than there used to be a generation ago. What do you feel about that?
Well, this may be true in some areas, but I'm not sure that the American public is very well educated about the Native American. And I can tell you that if you went to South Dakota today, you wouldn't see any change in the mentality, the feeling about Indians. I think that racism is one of the underlying causes of the friction between the two groups at Wounded Knee. I think the mixed bloods accept the stereotype of the Indian and are ashamed of that part of themselves and would rather identify with the non-Indian blood that they have. And my opinion of that is that these mixed bloods are never going to be white people in South Dakota. I think there's a real frontier mentality, and I think it was a real cowboys and Indians situation all over again out there.
You go right back to late 19th century attitude. You feel it's still that kind of attitude?
Yes.
Really? This surprises me because in our many conversations, my work in Alaska, I felt that the shift was tremendous. As the Native Americans improve economically, as they're better educated, they meet you on your own ground, and somehow a general shift in attitude. Would you feel that in places like South Dakota, that's still very strong?
Yes, and I think in Oregon that it probably was one of the reasons that a number of people were willing to accept termination of the tribe, because there was a degree of intermarriage, and the non-Indian community considered a mixed blood better than a full-blood Indian.
Mm.
And so the Indians gradually lost their own values and their self-esteem, and I think this is why they accepted termination and were in a hurry to be mainstream. They were accepting a theory that had been forced on them as a result of rather racist and stereotype attitudes.
True of the Catawbas, too, in the East.
Yes.
I'd like to come back to you, Mr. Lennon, and this question, if I may. It seems to me that an area in the Northwest, we just talked about this before our discussion, where you get a very strong group of Indians who have a very important political influence in politics, who are economically well off by Native American standards, certainly, and who are now developing what, as I see it, a very strong feeling for national culture, your tribal culture. Do you still feel, too, there's a sort of discrimination attitude like this in the Northwest?
Let's see, how do I say yes?
Don't say yes, say no.
Well,
I think it's, having served as the executive director of the Oregon Human Rights Commission, I would have to say that the evidence which Robert Kennedy compiled in his report on, I think it was called A National Tragedy and National Challenge, which describes the plight of Indian education in the United States, was that America, in terms of its government and its people and its ideas toward capitalism, as well as its ideas founded upon developing its nation state, are to achieve the total termination of Indian tribes and to receive the land from the Indian people and have it placed into the private domain of individuals or within the government agencies. And that strong a statement from a congressional inquiry, I think, is something that people should take very seriously. The idea of Emancipation Proclamation, you know, it's it's a sensitivity kind of situation that should be a warning to Americans about the attitude of the corporations and the attitude of the business executives who receive to let you know that the answers to America are in technology. And in fact, the answers to America, I think, are in philosophy. You know, the Renaissance period to the 1960s have to say a great deal about what we're talking about. And the multinational efforts of corporations in other countries, which have ripped off a great deal of natural resources from underdeveloped countries abroad, which have caused the rising of mistrust of America in almost every nation state around the world, have a great deal to do with the state of Oregon, because Indian tribes cannot trust state governments that believe that the control of education should be with the state departments, and our state departments, which have no idea of the background and basis of cultural life in a reservation, in a nation state of an Indian tribe, and conceivably can destroy an Indian personality from kindergarten to the 12th grade by placing upon them an educational system which is foreign, which in its nature talks about Middle America to the extent of destroying the total Native American personality. And I think racism, by its nature, has changed in the fact that there is not this total animosity and brutality of conflict, as you mentioned before. But indeed, it persists in the systematic institutionalization of education as well as government and its process interacting with reservation life.
I think it's what you're getting at, to a certain extent, isn't it?
Yes, and I don't think, I had to go as far west as South Dakota to find an example, because there is a problem right in western New York today within the Gowanda District, school district, problem of racism exercised against the parents' committee, who are the responsible Indian parents overseeing the use of Title IV funds.
What's Title IV? I'm sorry.
Title IV is the Indian Education Act. And these funds for the public school system are Part A of Title IV fund, and this Part A requires that there be a concerned parents committee. We have, I know three of the women on that committee, and they are militant people. Unfortunately, the term militant Indian has a bad connotation today, a negative connotation, and I think that is unfortunate, because we must be militant, nonviolent. But the district superintendent of this area has very effectively divided the community by saying, you are supporting those militant women, and responsible Indians don't want to be connected with someone that they think the non-Indian community considers irresponsible. Militant does not necessarily mean irresponsible.
Ms. Jackson, you're from a very quite different environment, in the sense that you're very much an urban environment, and did you say there were 800 Native American families in Philadelphia, something like that?
Well, yeah, in southeastern Pennsylvania, about 2 years ago, it should have been that many. We got them to admit it anyway. That's the problem, I think, that when you had Indians, two generations removed from their base, and they go into an urban center, very easy for them to assimilate into a culture that will accept them for something other than they aren't, because it's too difficult for them to be what they are, because they are by themselves. This was not my problem, because every summer, the day after school was out, I was on a train going home. No, staying in the city for me, for me to go to school. So through my growing up and learning years, I was exposed to both. Of course, I had no decision. I knew what I wanted. According to grandfather. But on the basis of racism in an urban environment for Indians, I think among the children it's more evident than it is among the adults, because I really haven't experienced any overt racism. If I were in a different area, much like where there were many more Indians, where they were had a possibility of having some political clout or economical clout, I'm sure there would be some racism of sorts, because racism is born out of, well, a lot of things, but it has to do with money most of the time. And so I really can't comment on the negative side of what you're talking about.
I can only comment among children, like I said, where my kids had problems when they were first going to school, simply because they were neither white nor black, and they weren't considered Oriental. And they were an oddity, and being an oddity, children can be cruel. I spent a few years talking to all three of my children as they came through elementary school and how to cope with it. And out of that was born the desire to form the organization we did form, because I did find there were other families here having the same problem.
Thank you. I think it's time for some of you to, do you have any questions or comments on this discussion, or if you'd like to join into this, we'd be glad to have you. To redirect it anyway. How about you?
That's about four per family. Figure out, you know, 800 families. All right. It's 3.8 per family. Are you?
Right. Who are you?
Linda Lewin.
Linda Lewin. I heard your name from the behind.
Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Yes, it certainly was a racist situation. That man who died lay there without medical attention for over 2 hours.
In other words, it wasn't just that he was, they thought he was rowdy, or, but he was recognizably something, I presume, to the police.
I think, Ted, you know that story. Maybe George should tell the story.
Well, my own comments about that, I was quite involved with that. I worked with the family, the Shenandoah family, and their initial fight to try and right the wrong. Because it definitely was a wrong, because the boys, they were part of the Center City community. They were working here for like 2 years, I think, prior to that, off and on. And they were well known among the law enforcement officers here in Center City. During that period, there had been no problems before that. The incident that brought about the police coming upstairs, they knew where they were going. There was no doubt in their minds that the Indians occupied this floor of the hotel. And as soon as the problem occurred in that building, it was right to that point. And they didn't concern themselves with the college students, the floor above or next door, who it's to be proven whether or not they did initiate the problem. But I feel that they directed all their efforts to that one, two apartments when they went in. I say yes, it definitely was. Because even if they didn't know before they went in there, after they got in there, and the altercations took place and people were identified, there was still no effort to give the man medical aid. And then after they had gotten to the police administration building, it was more indignant and self-defense. There's a lot that you don't know about.
They know police who they were. I mean, there was any whether they were they identified as a certain
group
of
Indians.
Yeah,
sure, they identified themselves
right away. Yeah,
they were all steel workers.
Right.
Yes.
The individual Indian on the reservation sells land, what's considered
You're the legal fellow here, aren't you? No, you should answer that.
I'm the legal fellow?
Aren't you? That's what you're going to be teaching.
This guy's pretty presumptuous over here on the left. I'm going to have to keep an eye on it.
Hmm?
I said you're pretty presumptuous. I'll be happy to attempt to answer that. There was a study done on an act called the Dawes Act, which was commissioned during the... There's an act called the Dawes Act. I'm not sure the date. You've got a historian. 1887, which committed to sell their land to non-Indians. And in 25 years after the sale, the land could actually leave the trust status of being under the federal government. That idea was to attempt to break the family ties as well as tribalism. Considered effort by the federal government to break down the tightness of a tribe. When you think about tribalism, you think about communal effort, about people sharing resources, about people doing things together. You know, having a family name or having an individual name of your tribe, you know, feeling a part of the tribe, you know, having a really good strength in the communal effort as a unit was something which the Indian people had in strength. And it's in the educational efforts as well as the legal efforts of the federal government. The federal government is attempting to do anything it could to weaken the whole status of an Indian organization or an Indian identity. And having them sell land was a way of doing it, to break the tribalism concept, to cut it up by letting them have pieces of land. I think it was 160 acres which people were allotted, and the rest of the land remained in the name of the tribe. And a lot of people did sell their land to non-Indians because upon receiving the land, they also were given farming implements and were given an opportunity to have other people come in and farm and rent their land. They became in debt because they had no practical business knowledge because they weren't trained in any practical business knowledge dealing with farming and dealing with agriculture. You know, a lot of this was not taught, so just by definition, they were going to become in debt, and as a result, some of them sold their land. Others rent their land now. In fact, on the Pine Ridge Reservation, they rent land for 43 cents an acre a year. And you can distinguish between an Indian person's farm and a Native American's house if you travel through a reservation. I remember traveling through Yakima once. I went down 1 mile, and I looked at the houses on the left and right, and the huge houses with brick houses with fancy lawns out in front, you know, just a really beautifully landscaped area where the farmers who were renting the land from the Indians. So you go down there, and there's a little shack on the end of the place, and that was the person who actually owned the land. If you went through that on the Pine Ridge Reservation, the situation was the same. And on the Crow Reservation, the situation was the same. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs holds the total power over a reservation to the extent that they have to approve everything that the tribal council does. And on the Crow Reservation, there's a fellow who protested because he said, you know, 43 cents an acre, that's not very much. You know, you've got this huge house, you've got all these implements, and that, you know, you must have about $1 million worth of assets. You know, 42 cents an acre for me, you know, per year, you know, I think he's getting $180 a year. So you can imagine how much land he has. And he was very proud of it, and he drove me through his acreage. You know, here's my land, and this is my land here, and he drove all over us, and I threw all, you know, food. And he mentioned a guy. I said, well, have you tried to get more? He said, yes, I went down there, but submitted a request that it be revised, but the BIA disapproved of the application and just had to find out continue on. So the BIA has awesome power over Indian tribes. When you talk about the autonomy of reservation, when the treaties were first made back in the 1850s, they were made under the notion that there was going to be a distinct entity, a new government. You know, and Vine DeLoria explains it very well when he talks about a treaty. A treaty is made to distinguish the borderlines between two nation states, two people with specific governments and economies, and that's why a treaty is made. However, the difference in the United States of treaties is that they're quasi-sovereign, in that there's a conquering nation which had conquered a people, but they realized the aboriginal rights of the tribes, and a great deal of the reason making treaties was it was costing the government too much money to kill Indians. And that's the reason that treaties were made. You know, there was no basic idea of diplomacy. You know, that, in fact, was a part of the mechanism to bring about a treaty. But the reason they were made was because of this, this cost to the government. However, recognizing that making a treaty was a very important diplomatic as well as international tool, and that treaties are the law of individuals' lands, that is, you know, they are the highest law of this land, as is recognized each time a new president takes office. And, you know, certainly is something I think is a very hypocritical kind of notion to give to the public of the United States at each inauguration. Since most of the treaties were broken, and those that weren't broken, something happened to them as a consequence.
I'd like to say something about the land situation at Allegheny and Cattaraugus, and that is that the land cannot be sold by an Indian to a non-Indian. An Indian will sell another Indian title rights to a certain section that he holds title rights to, but the land is held in perpetuity by the nation.
So you can rent it, I suppose. Yeah.
Yes, you can read this.
Yes?
What's the solution to the Bill of Indian Affairs problem? What kind of legal government
I want to see it out of the Department of Interior. As a separate office with cabinet.